It's the Wired Dakota UK podcast, episode 101 for Friday, the 16th of November, 2012. This week, we're back in our studio after a historic live performance for our 100th episode to discuss the health professor who has suggested that people should have a license to smoke, maybe. We'll discuss the incredible story of the man left in a vegetative state after a car accident who has managed to communicate using only his mind. And we'll try and provide our own answers to the question, should a sex offender be banned from the internet? We're pregnant with news triplets this week, and it's time to give birth. Wired midwives, if you would do the honours. Ahoy, ahoy, Nate Langston here, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, of course, associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Just wondered how many times I could pause there before.
I know, it was dramatic.
And of course, staff writer Ian Steadman.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
I think I actually officially just promoted you on this newsletter. Sorry.
I'll take it.
Okay, it's not a newsletter either, it's a script. So we're back, 101 episodes. We're now in our third year of casting pods. This is a miracle. Except it exists.
I guess we've spanned 3 years. It's not 3 years of casting pods.
We've done 2 years, which means we're now in our third year.
Yes.
Is the way I would put it. We wanted to point out, actually, that we've got another event coming up. Not a live podcast, but we've got a conference that one of our other Wired divisions, Wired Consulting, is putting on called Future London, which is taking place next week in London on the, what's the date, 22nd?
On the 20th.
20th. If you're interested in basically what is the future of London, now we've got some details on wired.co.uk. If you go and search for Future London, I highly advise you do. We're going to get on with some news, though. And the first thing is that there may be a license to smoke, Liv, if one gentleman has his wish.
Well, yeah, I don't know how realistic this wish is, but it's a public health professor in Sydney from the university there who has published a paper proposing this new system whereby smokers would have to have a license in order to buy cigarettes in the shops.
And they would have a fixed amount of cigarettes that they would actually be allowed to buy, right?
Yeah, they would have to buy a license depending on their level of smoking that they wanted to
Do.
You know, for example, maybe 70 cigarettes a week or 140 a week or whatever. And then they'd have to swipe that license every time they bought cigarettes. And then once they reached their kind of maximum level, they would no longer be able to purchase cigarettes. And the idea is this guy, Simon Chapman, is arguing that if we, you know, we have to have prescriptions for drugs, for controlled substances, painkillers, etc. So why not have some kind of prescription or license to carry cigarettes, which are also very addictive?
In a sense, kind of logical. I mean, I like the idea as part of this that new smokers would have to go through some sort of health risk test.
Yes.
To make sure they absolutely knew that they were at risk of various diseases and problems.
Yeah. There's about 1 billion smokers in the world, and a lot of them are lower income families and from developing nations. And so the idea is that perhaps a system like this might be able to discourage people people who are very price sensitive from smoking. But I don't know, it seems like a very complex system to put in place, given that in the UK we've, you know, people have been mooting things like an identity card and hasn't had any success in implementing something like that. So a bit of a logistical nightmare, and I don't see why there's any difference from this or just upping the price even further of the cigarettes.
Yeah.
There is the problem that it kind of does create a greater stigma around smoking in general as well. I mean, is that a bad thing?
Does it create a stigma, though? Because there's a certain point where it feels like smokers kind of do it to spite the government for trying to make it difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of argument that says that people, fewer drugs would be used, illegal drugs would be used if they were legal, because the kind of illicit thrill would be taken away.
I mean, as a former smoker, and I smoked for many, many years, I was instantly thinking of ways to get around this. I was imagining pooling resources with three friends to get a higher license. I'm sure there'd be economies of scale with the upper end of the license. And then, you know, and buying for your friends or buying for your family or whoever.
Driving down to Calais and loading up the trunk with the French ones where you don't need a license.
Exactly, or buying them online. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem practical at all, but I think, you know, and I think anything that can be done to reduce the number of smokers is a good thing. I mean, I do agree that it's a disgusting habit and it's a very expensive habit.
Yeah. Ian, do you think it would discourage younger or new smokers? Because that to me is part of the greater problem. It's not necessarily getting people who have smoked for 30 years off cigarettes. It's it's particularly about discouraging new smokers, you know, and to sort of basically phase it out.
Yeah,
I mean, could you imagine being 17?
I could see it just driving them to different things. So say there's like this increasing move. It seems like marijuana is becoming more like acceptable as tobacco is being cracked down on. They're kind of reaching the same kind of parity. So if it becomes really difficult to smoke tobacco, people, kids just might move on to marijuana, or they might move on to legal drugs. They might move just alcohol. I mean, why not alcohol for this as well? I mean, it's also very damaging. It's purely a recreational thing. People just like to damage themselves. That's the kind of thing we have to accept, I think.
An interesting idea suggested by another political scientist, Jeff Collin, was that perhaps putting time restrictions on when cigarettes can be sold. And I think that's quite... I know in a lot of shops won't sell alcohol after a certain hour, but I know, well, from my younger clubbing days, going into shops at whatever time in the morning, you can pick up a packet of cigarettes. And actually, if there were, I would be unlikely to smoke those extra 15 fags if I hadn't been able to buy a packet at...
That's a very, very interesting point, actually, because you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I've never had clubbing days, but I've certainly had days where I've been out at 4 a.m. still.
Yeah.
And, and people do. Yeah, they can just walk into 24-hour shops. I mean, for me, it's kind of walking into a shop at 5 a.m., you know, kind of drunk and buying like a kilogram of dairy milk. And just binging on that, or eating like a burger before getting the tube home and then getting off feeling hungry and buying another burger. Maybe we should have restrictions on times people can eat fast food as well. I don't know. But I think it's something that's going to be debated more and more as, you know, cigarettes in general are being cracked down on. I know that there are, I think it was Sainsbury's in Scotland that has now stopped selling cigarettes, or and there are many places in the country that have put up blinds in front of the cigarette kiosks.
That's the law now, isn't it? You have to.
If it is, I've seen a lot of places that are disobeying the law.
Yeah.
But certainly I've seen a lot of places where they have the kiosks, but they have kind of like plastic sheets over the front of them. And the idea is that, you know, you just have to know they're there in order to ask for them, as opposed to being there saying, hey, come and buy me. Let us know what you think. Podcast@wired.co.uk. It's something we didn't plan on talking about for quite this long, but it's clearly something that's important. And we'd very much like to hear what you think of it. We're going to move on to talking about something less bad for your health and a bit more good for your general sense of well-being and happiness, isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah, well, possibly. I want to ask, actually, though, first, have any of you, as in either of you, used StumbleUpon in the last 6 months?
No.
Last 6 years?
Maybe in the early part of those 6.
Okay. So StumbleUpon is a company that has been around for 10 years. I can't actually believe it. And to me, the service, which is basically about you press a button on your browser and you get shown a semi-random web page that is based on your interests. And the more that you say, yes, I like that, or no, I didn't like that, the more tuned to your personal preferences the future suggestions will become. And I met up with a woman yesterday called Teal Newland, who is a VP at StumbleUpon. And she was telling me that one of the things the company is very, very seriously investigating and talking about is the idea of real life stumbling. So instead of pressing a button on a web browser and getting a web page, you might be standing in the street with a StumbleUpon app and say, oh, well, I'm bored, I want to do something right now. And it says, and you press Stumble and you get an event pop up, or a restaurant, or a museum or something. And you could say, oh, well, I'm not interested in that, stumble again. And then, oh, that's pretty cool. That's, you know, only, you know, half a mile away or something like that. Maybe I'll go and do that.
Yeah.
The idea of taking these online kind of semi-random suggestions into the real world, which I think could be a very, very interesting new way for a company like StumbleUpon to diversify.
Yeah, I like the idea. I would say that I'm not sure how many occasions there are when I'm out in the street just wondering what I should be doing with my time.
You know, but I mean, I was thinking, you know, if you're on holiday and you've got a spare couple of hours to kill, you could press Stumble, and, you know, if it was connected theoretically to your StumbleUpon account, it would know that I'm into music and technology and photography. It might say, well, hey, you're only 300 yards from this photography gallery, and I'd be thinking, oh, that's cool, I'll go and check that out.
No, that's a very good point.
An hour. And this was all kind of hypothetical in terms of exactly how the service would be used, but Teal was saying that it's very much it's absolutely in the future for us, is the quote. And she said, quote, stumbling through London, you could say, I don't care what you show me, I just want to find new things. And I think that that is, you know, is quite interesting for a company that's traditionally just an online toolbar or something.
Yeah, but it makes perfect sense. Yeah. I think it's a great idea. Mm. Really.
We'll keep our eye close on that. Ian, I want to talk about a bit of science.
Yes.
Very interesting story that we had on the website this week. Why don't you tell us about brains?
Yeah, this is a man who's in a vegetative state, has spoken to doctors and told them he's not in pain using only the power of thought. This is Mr. Scott Routley, or Routley. I apologise, Scott, if you're listening.
Canadian, I believe.
He's Canadian. He was in a car accident and he was left in a vegetative state. This is not a coma. Vegetative state is kind of, you look awake, but you're non-responsive. You know, you don't respond when people wave things in front of your face or when they touch you.
And this was 12 years ago as well.
Yeah, so it's a long time ago. And through that time, everyone was kind of, you know, thought he was severely brain damaged. They knew he was severely brain damaged. They assumed that his mental processes were also damaged. You know, they weren't aware what kind of consciousness has survived. But a group of doctors put him in an MRI machine to look at his brain. And this is a team who have developed this technique where if you imagine, the examples they use is they told the people to imagine playing tennis. Because when you play tennis, it lights up the premotor cortex. And if you imagine that you're just kind of walking around the house, that apparently lights up the parahippocampal gyrus.
Well done.
Yes. and those two parts of the brain are completely different. So when you ask someone to say, you know, they ask them a question, it's a yes or no question, and you say, for yes, think about playing tennis. For no, think about walking around the house. And they chose Scott because he was someone who responded very well to the initial trials of being able to think of these two different things. They tested him with questions to make sure that he wasn't just thinking of random stuff. And they scanned his brain and they managed to ask him questions. Are you in pain? He said no. And it's the first time that anyone has managed to communicate this way to doctors. Wow. There's Adrian Owen, who's the co-author of the study. And he said, we scanned him several times and his pattern of brain activity shows he's clearly choosing to answer our questions.
Wow.
Wow.
They tested on some other patients though as
they
well.
Did,
he wasn't
yeah.
a one-off.
They went to the Royal Hospital of Neurodisability, where they found out that 43% of the patients who were tested also showed similar brain activity, which is pretty amazing. And across several different samples, it averaged out at about 1 in 5 patients that appeared to be able to communicate in this way.
It's terrifying to think of how many people are in these sorts of states who may you know, be able to understand what's being said around them and haven't been able to communicate at all.
Yeah, apparently they've specifically not asked any of the patients whether they want to have their life support turned off, whether they want to end their lives, because
yeah.
of the ethical questions that would bring. They're kind of avoiding it at the moment. But a neuroscientist, Brian Young, did say that the textbooks would have to be rewritten about yeah. people in vegetative states because they just simply thought that kind of brain damage really did destroy your kind of consciousness.
Tell me about Stephen Graham.
Yes, he's a different patient who, quite excitedly, he when they asked him if he was aware that his sister had had a daughter, he said yes, but his sister had a daughter after he'd gone into the vegetative state, so he gained new knowledge even while he was in that state. So it's not just ticking over in there. They're actually actively still thinking, which is exciting, but also again
deeply
terrifying.
Depressing. Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's talk about protesting. There's another story we've had on the website this week, specifically focusing on internet law.
Yes.
In the region of protesting.
Yeah. Well, the United Arab Emirates has just decreed a whole new load of amendments to an existing law about how people communicate online, specifically people who criticise rulers or the state online. So the president, Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan, has decreed this law, and it's a terrifying, terrifying load of restrictions. So the first one is you're not allowed to criticise or deride the reputation of the president, any of the rulers, the crown princes, deputy rulers, national flag, national anthem, or any emblem of the state, or you could face prison. There's also amendments made about online protest. So you're not allowed to call for the overthrow of systems of government, as we've seen in places like Egypt, or oppose the basic principles which constitute the foundations of the system of government or state. It's all very kind of lofty words.
Yeah, but frighteningly broad as well.
Yeah, and this includes provisions for demonstrations, marches or similar activities unless they have been licensed specifically. And it also covers things like pornographic material, which is perhaps more expected, gambling activities and other indecent acts, which is just hideous,
indecent,
vague.
Is that what it says?
Yeah.
Indecent. I mean,
so vague.
But I mean, it also covers, I think, selling organs and selling drugs and selling, you know, yeah. human trafficking.
And these
things
are things
that might be not as controversial to restrict.
No. And there's some worrying things about privacy as well. Obviously, you know, we need laws to protect people's privacy, but they've said any people using websites for unwarranted violation of privacy, and this can include taking pictures of others, publishing any news, photos or comments, even if they're authentic, which I take to mean if they're true. And so, I mean, from an investigative journalist point of view, this is, again, pretty terrifying.
Well, you couldn't be an investigative journalist.
No.
I mean, a lot of times you can think that news is the stuff that people don't want to be published.
Yeah.
And if this is stuff that people in that country don't want to be published, then your country has no news as
no.
such. You only have fluff.
Yeah, I mean, news in the
propaganda.
UAE has always been a little bit fluffy for exactly this reason, but it's the first time it's been probably cemented into the law with specific reference to the internet.
Mm.
And people who contravene these laws face prison sentences and having all of their devices seized and their websites taken down.
Now, it's not dissimilar to a lot of restrictions, actually, just going off kilter a little bit here, that we have in North Korea.
No.
I mean, their state media is, you know, famously tight. I mean,
yes.
Ian, you've actually...
Well, there's only this state.
Yeah. I mean, whenever we see, state media clips provided on, you know, news channels that we have over here, you know perfectly well that the government wants that clip to
oh,
be
yeah.
seen.
Definitely.
And so there is no concept of news or, you know...
I don't think there's any concept of the press as we would know it. Mm. It's just, the vocal organ of the state, as it were.
Yeah. I guess a slightly strange thing with the United Arab Emirates is they're quite a big, we kind of see them as allies. Generally, they're seen as quite moderate for that region.
Isn't Qatar part of the Emirates?
Qatar, yeah.
They're hosting the World Cup.
Yeah. I mean, it's generally seen as...
Well, that's not that different to some of the restrictions that LOCOG appeared to put on.
Yeah, well, I mean, the LOCOG ones are really bad, but Qatar has said if gay couples go to the World Cup in 2022 in Qatar and they're caught engaging in homosexual activity, which is illegal under Qatari law, they will be prosecuted, which can involve, like, you know, prison sentences
yeah.
and stuff. And it's and I think FIFA president Sepp Blatter just said kind of like, deal with it. Which is...
Well, we've got 10 years to change that then.
Yeah.
Mm.
When are these restrictions going into place?
They've been decreed, so they're in law.
They're in place now.
Yeah.
As ever, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk or leave us a message on our Facebook wall, facebook.com/wiredUK. Very keen, as always, to hear your thoughts on any of these stories or anything else we've discussed in the show. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to discuss the court that has overturned a sex offender's web ban after calling the ban unreasonable.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Liv, let's talk about sex offenders. It's something you've written about this week
yes.
in response to something Liat has written about this week. Tell us about Philip Michael Jackson, first of all.
Yes. Now, Philip Michael Jackson is a 55-year-old man who in June was convicted of using a mobile phone camera placed into a shampoo bottle to spy on a 14-year-old girl in the shower and, you know, take pictures of her. Once police kind of arrested him for this, they also found loads of inappropriate images of children on his computer, and he was banned from using the internet. Now, he's appealed this ban, and this week two judges have overthrown the order, saying that nowadays it's entirely unreasonable to ban anybody from accessing the internet in their home. And so instead, Jackson now has to just give police access to his web browsing records. I say just, that's still, still quite a big deal. But it's very interesting in terms of the precedent it sets, because it suggests that having access to the internet is sort of a human right, even for people who are distributing or just collecting child pornography. And I think it's a very, very interesting ruling.
Yeah, well, it's saying getting banned from the internet is fine if you've been downloading some Rihanna MP3s, but it's absolutely, absolutely not if you've been using it, or rather if you are a convicted sex offender taking photos of underage girls.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure it's saying it's fine. I guess it just, it presents a lot of problems for the laws that are trying to argue that it's fine to cut people off.
I guess we're still in a state where British law has kind of come to deal with the internet, so everything's a bit inconsistent still.
Yes,
I mean, you
exactly.
can see that in just the way that people are free speech and stuff on Twitter
yes.
and things.
Well, let's talk about the three strikes law, because this is something that the Digital Economy Act is trying to introduce. I think they're hoping to have it in place by 2014,
yeah.
if memory serves. This would make it rather difficult, I think, for that to happen, if a judge has said, no, we can't ban people from the net at all.
Exactly. Well, that was the kind of real teeth to the Digital Economy Act, was the idea that you'd if you downloaded pirated copyright infringing content, you'd get three warnings, and then at the end of that warning, one of the kind of meatiest punishments would be to be disconnected from the internet. But yes, as we're seeing, there's been a precedent set in another case, and it's that rules this as unreasonable. So it will be very hard to block people in this way.
And what about hackers as well? I mean, we've seen hackers kicked offline.
Yeah, exactly. Jack Davis, who was the kind of public face of Lulzsec, a guy based in the Shetland Islands, he was the guy who hacked into SOCA, Serious Organised Crime Agency's website, and he was banned from using the internet as well. His mum was told, he was 19, I think, and his mum was told he wasn't allowed to use the internet.
He's been a very naughty boy.
but even regardless of whether you think it's a basic human right or not, it's utterly impractical. I mean, you might get cut off from your home computer, but there's always Wi-Fi,
yes.
next door neighbor's Wi-Fi, your mobile phone, internet cafes. I mean, I just can't imagine any situation where it would be possible to put this into place.
It's kind of like when you look at what Jackson had, where he had to give the police access to his web history. It's
yeah.
kind of like the web equivalent of having to wear one of those like ankle bracelet things.
But it's
yeah.
not, though, is
so
it?
Still
because it's giving it
around.
It's post-use. So he's being able to say, this is what I have looked at, as opposed to, here's where I am. You know,
yeah.
I've run
yeah.
out of my you know, virtual barrier.
You can imagine a situation where they might do, I don't know how exactly they monitor his web history, but you can imagine a situation where they might try and install some device that tracked you as you went along. And whether or not you agree with that, that's a much more moderate approach than blocking someone from the internet.
You would have thought that something like active deep packet inspection would have been more realistic in this case. It would give them access to the web. So, okay, well, we're going to let you use Google to find what the weather's like,
yeah.
or to read the news, or to look up your own rights as a citizen.
Yeah.
But we will be monitoring this in real time to make sure that if we spot any suspicious activity, we can, you know, pursue whatever avenue needs to be pursued
yeah.
to stop that. That, to me, even though I don't agree in any way with deep packet inspection as a general rule, in terms of, law enforcement or people who are convicted
yeah.
of a criminal offence that may or may not have involved the internet, then it seems to me more viable
yeah.
as a restriction.
Especially as more and more government services go online. I mean, it becomes almost impossible now to do a lot of stuff
yeah.
if you're not able to go online.
On one hand, we're talking about digital by default,
yeah.
know, any kind of engagement with public services. And on the other side, we're talking about cutting people off from the internet. It doesn't add up.
It raises some interesting questions, you know, particularly thinking about digital Britain, the idea of everyone in the country having access to at least 2 megabits per second.
Mm.
You know, is this sort of human right or this entitlement to access to the internet, is that entitlement to the wide internet? Is it access to a fast, speedy internet? Is it access to net neutrality or tiered internet? You know, it's lots of restrictions could be placed that don't actually just say no internet, but
yeah.
restricted or firewalled or whatever. Let us know what you think. It's my catchphrase this episode, Podcast of Word at Good UK. It's thought-provoking topics this week. We've put our brains together and created a hyperbrain, and it's arguing with itself. We want some help, please. Send your brains in. Last story I want to get to is something you wrote about, Ian. And the thing that struck me as being the most interesting in this was a quote halfway down the story about it being a pop idol for farmers.
Yes.
Which is just such a great mental image. Just think about that for a second. Think about Somerset farmers, guys in the West Country maybe. on Pop Idol. There you go. Take it away, Ian. What's the news here?
This is the work of a company called Digital Green, who are based in Delhi. They work with lots of international agricultural development NGOs in India, Ghana, and Ethiopia. And they've created this thing called Farmer Book, which, as I say, they call it like a pop idol for farmers. And it's the way it works is to basically get farmers in these countries to teach each other about how to farm. Because if you think about it, like, imagine you're a big Western NGO and you come into a country like India and you go around and you're trying to get people to be better at growing crops. Like, you know that there's a better way that they could be growing cucumbers or broccoli or whatever, but you try and tell them and they don't trust you because you're an outsider and you don't speak their language properly, and you know there's a lot of suspicion around Western ways and things like that. So Digital Green came up with this idea where they'd get farmers to film themselves planting crops and growing stuff, then send those videos, only like 8 to 10 minutes long, they're not too long. They have in each village, in each district, there's what they call a facilitator, who's a guy who's been trained to use a little Pico projector, and they send these videos to them one a week. And they sit down with everyone in the village and they play the video and they ask, they like, while they're playing it, they pause it, they rewind it, they ask questions to make sure that everyone who's watching it understands it. And at the end, they get everyone to rate it with a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And while this is going on, the facilitator is kind of writing down who's asked the question, what have they asked, all that kind of stuff. And they log all that online on this farmer book. So the farmer doesn't really have to create anything. They get this profile on the site, so you can go on there and you can see the farmer, you can see every video they've seen, every practice they've adopted and what video it came from. You can see any questions they asked, you can see all that kind of stuff. And it's really cool because it allows NGOs to basically see really easily how knowledge is spreading around in these places where they're working. And it's a lot cheaper than hiring a lot of say Western people to come in and sort of go around, spend ages training them, going around and not achieving very much, sort of the farmers teach themselves and it works a lot better.
I suppose you could apply exactly the same model to something like healthcare.
Yeah, exactly. Or sanitation or anything like that. And FarmBook's really cool because there's a leaderboard where every farmer is ranked, like in each district and stuff. So you can see who's the best at adopting new techniques and things like that. And it's all about kind of connecting them to each other, because they say that when they show these videos to the farmers from other villages, their first question is not like, oh, what is that? That's a really cool way of growing broccoli. It's, who is this guy? And, you know, what's his name? Where's he from? So this website allows them to see the people that they're learning from.
That's awesome.
And develop this kind of trust.
Farmer Book, plus Farmer a great name. I wonder if you could tie this in with services like... what's that? What's the donation? The microloans payment system? Not Kickstarter. No, the other one. The one that's
Kiva.
Yeah.
You can imagine sort of that. Those two sort of businesses almost complementing each other in a certain way. Where you know, for someone who is lending money or applying for money or whatever, is, you know, they've got these videos and they've got, say, a backing from these facilitators or whoever. To sort of say, this person actually is really good in this particular area and, you know, could benefit from...
It's like learning from kind of entrepreneurs in another part of the country who've set up a stall doing, you know, offering some kind of service and learning from their mistakes and et cetera.
Yeah, it's really cool because it's really just setting up networks and then letting people do what they do best, which is sharing stuff across them.
Fascinating idea. We've got a story about this on the site. Where do people find that? What do they type into our search box?
If you search Farmer Book or...
Farmer Book.
Yeah.
You heard it here just now. Not first necessarily. Not even necessarily last. But you've heard it here. That is going to wrap up our show for this week, our 101st show. Very exciting to be in the post-100 digits, isn't it, Liv?
It is.
On a scale of 1 to 101, how excited would you say you are?
111.
Wow.
You're centurions now.
We all are. Well, you can let us know what you think of our 101st or indeed our previous 100 shows by emailing us podcast@wired.co.uk. Liv has the words needed to tell you how to go on our Facebook page.
Yes, it's facebook.com/wired.uk. And we're also on Twitter.
We are.
Do you want to tell them how to contact us on Twitter?
No, they're smart listeners. I'll figure it out. also, though, I wanted to remind people about the Future London event that we have got coming up next week, if you're listening to this on the 16th or around that date of November. Find out more on the website by searching Future London on wired.co.uk. And I think on that note, we will see you next week.
Cheerio.
Bye. he worked here, or do you think
I think he was a delivery boy.